You're listening to MLB.com Extras, brought to you by MLB.tv. It's baseball everywhere.
Hi, everybody. Welcome to MLB.com Extras. I'm Matthew Leach, talking National League East today with MLB.com's NL East beat reporters. We've taken a look at all of the various injury situations around the Washington Nationals, especially Anthony Rendon's situation, plus checking in on who might be the opening day starter. We're looking at Cliff Lee's situation with the Phillies and how it impacts the rest of the roster and possibilities of trades of Cole Hamels and Chase Utley and all the other guys that the clubs are calling about. With the Braves, we'll be talking about Jace Peterson, who may have emerged as the primary second baseman, and Eric Young Jr., who may have emerged as the primary center fielder. Miami Marlins, we'll be talking Danny Heron and the back of the rotation and taking a look back at the Dontrell Willis mania. And with the Mets, we'll be looking at all angles on Zach Wheeler's injury and apparent upcoming surgery. This is MLB.com Extras. I'm Matthew Leach. Thanks, everybody, for listening. Talking Washington Nationals with MLB.com's Nationals beat reporter, Bill Ladson. Bill, it seems like the Nationals can't go even a couple of days without some sort of injury news this spring. The ongoing thing these days, the big ongoing thing these days, seems to be Anthony Rendon. What's his situation? How far away is he? What's going on with Rendon right now?
I spoke to Rendon this morning, and he's still feeling the pinch in his knee. He has a sprained MCL, and he really doesn't know when he'll be back. I mean, he seems to think he'll be ready for opening day, but he still has the wrap around his knee, and he still hurts a little bit. So right now, it's still up in the air, and this will be a blow if he doesn't make it for opening day.
What's the contingency plan there? If he, you always have some moving parts there. If he is not ready to go for even a few days, what's plan B behind Rendon?
Well, right now, plan B, they've been playing Ian Stewart lately, and he's having a great spring. But I still think it's a long shot he makes the team. We'll see what happens. But so far, so good for Ian Stewart. I mean, he's really hit the ball really well. Even, he's hit for power as well. So right now, that's the plan right now. The plan is to have him, Kevin Franson as the backup, play third base right now. So that's the plan right now.
Stewart's also a heck of a keyboard player. Oh, wait, that's neither here nor there. With Rendon, is there kind of a cutoff date? I mean, presumably we're not talking by any means 3 weeks before he can play in a game, but you do need some prep time. Is there a point that he's got to be back getting at bats, playing some innings in the field, and getting ready after which they might have to make a decision to do something about the opening day roster?
Well, as of now, the answer is no. But Matt Williams is realistic that something could happen, that the MCL might not heal fast enough. He's aware of that. He's mentioned it a few times this week. But right now, there's no cutoff date, no deadline or anything like that. As of right now, they're still expecting him, especially Matt Williams, still expecting him to be ready for opening day.
And as far as Denard Span, that's not obviously a new injury, but you talked to him recently. And when we talked a week ago, it was just sort of, it's going to be a while, but we really don't know. Now we're saying it's almost certainly at least until sometime in May.
Correct.
What's his sort of read on it? I mean, as he looks at this situation, what's Span seeing?
Well, obviously he's upset that he can't play, and in retrospect, it seems like he should have had the surgery once the postseason ended, but he was told to rest, and he rested until December, and obviously nothing worked, so he had that hernia surgery, and then after that, he had that abdominal surgery later on, so he's pretty upset. I mean, I know he wished he could play right now, but it's tough for him to even sit down. I actually saw him sit in front of his locker room and his locker, and he was really in pain, it looked like. So it's too bad because he's going to be missed. They need a leadoff hitter for sure.
And the guy that stands next to him that is every bit as important lineup, Jason Worth, how's he coming along?
Well, I saw Jason Worth take batting practice this morning, and he looked pretty good. The batting practice, the pitcher was soft tossing it to him. But his swing looked pretty good. He admitted he was sore afterwards, but that was to be expected. That's what you get when you don't swing the bat after a while. But and starting this week, hopefully, he will play defense only in a minor league game. So we'll see how that goes. He's still shooting for opening day. That's what he told me this morning.
If he's not there opening day, I know we talked about this some last week, but it becomes realer and realer as we're 3 weeks from opening day and Jason Worth is going to need some bats and innings. If we get to opening day and Worth and Span are both out, are both not part of the lineup, or even if Worth is just maybe a not everyday guy, a guy that you play and then give a breather to, we know Michael Taylor is almost certainly fits into one of those. Who's the other guy that get some at-bats and get some starts during any amount of time of the regular season if they're doing without two of their starting outfielders?
Well, if he stays healthy, I see Nate McLaws. I also see Kevin Franzen. I mean, Kevin Franzen, I have to tell you, he doesn't put up the numbers, obviously, but he is, Matt Williams' favorite player. I'm just telling you. And he'll see a lot of playing time. And, you know, I got to keep an eye on a guy by the name of Clint Robinson. He's a career minor leaguer. But that guy can hit. He's having a great spring. They really lately they've been putting him in the outfield. He's a first baseman by trade, but they're putting him in the outfield to see how well he can do. He's not bad out there. He's not a Gold Glover by any stretch, but he's really hitting the ball as well. So it's going to be interesting to see how well those guys play.
I know I asked you about him last week, but. At least according to the numbers, Tyler Moore is still hitting. Is he a guy that maybe figures in there somewhere? Or is he strictly an infielder at this point?
Well, you know what? He could play the outfield as well. He's been playing the outfield for the Nationals. He could be another guy that could be in that lineup as well. I mean, he's having a great spring. He's out of minor league options, as you know. And, I still say that he could be traded before spring training. It's a wait-and-see type of deal with him.
It's an amazing team to talk about because essentially what we're going to spend this entire 10 minutes going injury by injury. What's the latest with Yunel Escobar?
Well, Yunel Escobar is supposed to start baseball activities this week. Apparently he's doing some little things, on the field, but no hitting yet. I'm expecting that to increase by the end of the week. So that injury is not serious. So hopefully we can see him in game action, hopefully by next week.
So that's something where they really are pretty confident that he'll be fine by the time the season starts?
Yes. Yes, no. They're not worried about that at all. No, not at all.
And the same applies for Drew Storen. It sounds like there's no real concern there?
No, he's actually throwing on the mound already. Got to remember, he had the hamate bone problem in his left hand. So he's okay. He should be in a game pretty soon. So that... he'll be ready for opening day.
To turn it to a happier topic, finally, as we spend nearly three-quarters of this talking about guys who are dealing with injuries, one of the things that you addressed recently on Nationals.com is the question of the opening day starter. Now, I think if you do enough, you cover enough baseball, you know that really the difference between who's one and who's two and who's three really only matters on opening day and in the playoffs. But with that said, it's a fun question. And it's very clear the Nationals have a lot of viable options, at least three, and if you wanted to say four, I don't think anybody would tell you were insane. What do you see? How do you see them looking at answering that question?
In my opinion, Matthew, I still think it's going to be Strasburg. He has been the opening day star the last 3 years. I don't see any reason to change, unless you want to go by the dollar figures, and that would obviously be Scherzer. But, we spoke to Scherzer on Sunday, and he doesn't care who's the opening day starter. I mean, he doesn't care if he's the guy or not the guy. But I have to think it's going to be Strasburg, followed by Zimmerman, followed by Scherzer, Pfister, and then GL. So I don't see Matt Williams changing there.
And they don't even get that cop-out that you sometimes get. Sometimes when you got that question and you open on the road, you can give one guy the opening day start and one guy the home opener start.
Yes, correct. I still think it's going to be Strasburg.
And one last thing before I let you go. How is the Ryan Zimmerman defensive experiment's obviously the wrong word. It's not an experiment. But how is the defense coming for Ryan Zimmerman?
So far, so good. the one thing, Matthew, I've told you this before, that don't expect to see Adam LaRoche there. He's not going to be Adam LaRoche. But he can scoop the balls from the dirt. He's done a great job at that. But in terms of, you know, the range, he's not going to be Adam LaRoche by any stretch. So, you know, I'm expecting him, if I were to rate him from a Stratomatic type of rate or range, I would give him a 3 right now, which is okay. So that's what I would give Zimmerman right now. I mean, I'm expecting it to go up to a 2 maybe later on, but it's going to take some time.
Bill, we talked 1960s Rolling Stones and Stratomatic. I can only call this a successful podcast. Thanks for taking some time to chat here on MLB.com Extras. I'm talking Atlanta Braves with MLB.com's Braves beat reporter Mark Bowman. Mark, it seems like maybe a little bit of a surprise that Jace Peterson has not only played his way into a spot on the team, but if I'm reading your stuff correctly, may have even played himself into being the primary second baseman. Is that an accurate read, and is it as much of a surprise as it seems to be from here?
Yeah, it's certainly a surprise, especially if we had this conversation maybe, you know, the day before we came to spring training, before you get your first look at Jace Peterson, a guy who had some limited time there with San Diego last year. A guy who has risen through their minor league system, San Diego's minor league system, after being a two-sport star at McNeese State. Just a very athletic guy. One of those guys that just kind of sticks out. I don't know if he's going to be, you know, develop into an elite second baseman. I don't want to tout him as anything like that, but he's just a one of those steady guys that is certainly appears to be a better option than Alberto Callaspo. It was a little bit of a reach, maybe even he was definitely a reach, let's put it that way, during the offseason when they targeted him to play second base and spend some time at third base.
How do you really feel about Callaspo, Mark? Don't hold it in.
Yeah, I mean, I talked to, you know, some of our other guys when they had the signing, and they didn't, you know, they weren't real high on him. The Angels, those who cover the Angels and the A's. He came to camp overweight, and that's been a problem for him the last couple of years. And he convinced the Braves he was going to hire a personal trainer. Well, if he did, I think he may have fired that personal trainer after he signed that contract there in early December. So, you know, he does not seem to be an everyday player. Jace Peterson has stood out. You know, I think he will get plenty of the reps there, and you know, as I hinted, it may not just be playing second base. He may also play third base when Chris Johnson sits against some right-handers. The other choice there is Phil Gosselin, who I see as a better option than Callaspo as well.
You mentioned, and I actually hadn't realized this, you mentioned that Peterson played two sports. Rio Ruiz, same thing. Terrell Jenkins, same thing. That was an old... When the Braves were on top, that was something that they really seemed to do a lot of. The guys they drafted and developed weren't just baseball players; they were athletes, and their pitchers were all athletes and could hit. Is that the acquisition of those guys maybe reflective of one of the ways that this new old regime is trying to get back to the way things used to be?
Yeah, I think so. I think we're starting to see them target the better athletes, the guys that. It might, I think recently a lot of their draft picks have been, you know, what we all term as safe picks. Now they're reaching out and trying to get the athletes. It's certainly targeting speed. You see a lot more speed in the system right now. But, yeah, the guys like Rio Ruiz, who could have played quarterback at USC, Harold Jenkins, who could have played quarterback at Baylor, Jace Peterson, a guy who played DB in college. You are seeing more of those kind of athletes that you saw come in here before, and some of that may have to do with the fact that they have brought back some of their old scouts. Roy Clark is now back in the system after being gone for a few years, so I think that old mindset is back. And, you know, as you heard many times, Sherholtz said, we want to get back to the Braves way, and now I'm on that. I need to tell you something. You know, when Freddie got toss last week in the first inning, you know, spring training game. He's sitting there with Bobby Cox last week, and John Schirrlitz walked by, and Trey goes, hey, John, I'm just trying to get back to the Braves way here, you know, trying to get back to the old days of Bobby. And Schirrlitz had a laugh with that.
Looking around, the other sort of guy who's really emerged, it seems, is Eric Young Jr. What exactly has he shown? I mean, everybody knows he's fast, but that's not exactly the same thing as playing center field. What has he shown to sort of play his way into what seems like a pretty big opportunity?
Yeah, and I think, you know, when that center field spot opened up, when Upton went down with the foot injury, the initial thought was, you know, he has not played enough center field. They'll probably end up putting Yuri Perez or Todd Cunningham, two guys who have played that position throughout the minor leagues. You know, they'll be much more comfortable in that spot. But what we've seen from Eric Young is, look, yes, he is unfamiliar with balls off the bat. Maybe he doesn't take the best routes, but his speed does make up for it. And John Hart said right away, he said, look, you know, I had Kenny Lofton for many years in Cleveland. He didn't take the best routes, but he had the kind of speed that he can make up for or to compensate for some of the bad routes that he takes. And, you know, Eric Young has shown that he's willing to put in the time. He's working hard with Bo Porter, who's the third base coach who handles the outfielders from a defensive perspective. He works with him a lot. And what we've seen is, you know, he's ranged to his left. He's ranged to his right. He's come forward. His arm is okay for center. I mean, center field, it's adequate. And to tell you the truth, you know, what we've seen from him is certainly every bit as good as what we've seen from Melvin Upton in the last couple of years. So I think, in Upton's absence, he'll be fine in that position. And, you know, in a couple weeks or months here, we'll be talking. I'm sure one of the questions you'll be asking me is, what are they going to do when Upton comes back?
Or why are they sticking with Eric Young Jr. when he's not hitting, if that might also
happen? Well, there's that part of the equation as well. So, yeah, that's going to be somewhat of a concern. You're hoping that he gets on base enough and puts the ball in play to where he can use that speed. But like you said, as you're alluding to, you can't steal first base, and you saw that his numbers dropped significantly last year with the Mets, and you wonder if that's a trend. But for now, I think they're saying, hey, look, we're going to give him a chance, see if this works. And the other interesting angle to that is they have been, you know, as you've seen and read, that they've been putting Peraza out there in center field. He hasn't played in the game yet. He'll be supposed to play in some games on the minor league side. Maybe if Eric Young doesn't work after a few weeks and there's still questions about when Upton's returning, or, you know, obviously there will be lingering questions about what you're going to get when Upton returns, maybe Peraza does end up being an option there in center field as well.
One thing that we have talked about in the past, in recent weeks, is that if this club is going to surprise, and I have a weird hunch they're a little better than some of the conventional wisdom out there has them. But if they're going to surprise and actually contend, it's going to have to be on the back of the starting rotation. And I am Mr. Don't Put Too Much Into Small Sample Sizes, but I'm looking at how the rotation has been. You know, the front guys have struggled, but that'll happen. But it looks like really nobody has seized that opportunity to take that fifth spot. I mean, even Wandy Rodriguez, 5 Ks, 5 walks. What's the back of the rotation looking like? Is Wandy clearly emerging as the guy, and how does that kind of look like it's going to come together?
If you want to look simply at small sample sizes, which is not the intelligent approach, as you said, you know, yes, Wandy Rodriguez and Eric Stoltz, that seems to be the right fit for the final two rotation spots, with two being open, given that Minor is going to start the year on the DL, the hope is maybe he would return in late April. So let's put Eric Stoltz in one of those spots for sure, and let's argue against Wandy Rodriguez. Yes, he was okay the other day against the Astros. He did let the bottom of the lineup load the bases. He got out of it that jam. Even when we've asked some of the other guys around the clubhouse, you know, how did he pitch? You know, it's just, hey, you know, okay. There's nothing that jumps out about Wandy. Now, do you want to go ahead and pay him $2 million, knowing that he failed a physical with the Phillies in December after signing a minor league contract with them or agreeing to a minor league contract with them? You know, he's made 18 starts the last 2 years. Do you want to really just pay him, you know, with the, you know, the gamble that he could very easily end up on the DL for most of the season? The other part of that equation is Minor. You know, is Minor going to come back and, you know, by the end of April, then are you paying Wandy just for a few starts? And then there's the other part of that is if you put him at the back end of the rotation with Stoltz, now all of a sudden you got two pretty similar pitchers pitching back-to-back, 4 and 5. Now, yeah, you could split them up, but at the same time, I just don't see the attraction with putting Wandy in that rotation. Now, when I mention Minor, somebody could come back and legitimately say, well, why isn't Minor considered every bit as much of an injury risk? And, hey, that's fair. But at the same time, I just think that if they can get anything for Wandy, and I'm not thinking that they're going to get anything significant, much maybe a double-A pitcher or something, a marginal player, I think that maybe just try to get something out of him, trade him, and just go ahead and fill the rotation with Cody Martin, who, you know, he's not going to light up the right radar guns. He's not going to, you know, impress you with any of his stuff, but you know, he's a guy that could fit there in the back of the rotation until either Minor's ready or until Mike Foltynewicz, you know, has some time to go down to the AAA level and start to get a better command, you know, more consistent location, better command, and most importantly, a better feel for his secondary stuff to where he can be more of a pitcher than a thrower.
Mark Bowman, thanks for taking some time to chat here on MLB.com Extras, talking New York Mets with MLB.com Mets beat reporter Anthony Giacomo. You have had a rather eventful spring already. A lot of that is, at least the most recent of that is unfortunate. How did this kind of come together? Because the Mets, until very recently, were saying, we're not worried, this happens all the time, and then we're not worried, and he is dealing with the same stuff he's always dealt with, is Zach Wheeler's out for the year.
Yeah, I actually went back and counted the night before we learned that Zach Wheeler had torn his UCL and was going to need Tommy John surgery. And the night before, we talked to Terry Collins out in Port Charlotte after a game, and went back and counted, and it was something like 8 or 9 times he said, I'm not concerned, just in response to various different questions. I'm not concerned. And it really, every indication was that the Mets weren't concerned. Zach Wheeler had gone for a couple MRIs already, one at the end of last season, one over the winter, and those came back clean. There was no signs that the ligament had been damaged. And then all of a sudden he goes for another one last weekend, and the UCL is completely torn. And that's a huge injury, and that's going to knock him out for the entire season. So we're still sort of unraveling how this all came about, what the Mets knew, when they knew it. It's clear at this point that Wheeler's elbow was barking, way back last summer. The Mets knew about it at the time. Their training staff, their doctors said he was fine to pitch through it. And so he did. And how much that played into what happens now, when it happens, nobody knows. And that's sort of the issue, not just with the Mets, but all around baseball. With all these Tommy John injuries that are coming up, there is no science behind it. No one has the magic formula where if you throw X number of pitches at Y velocity, at Z age, you know, whatever it might be, no one knows. No one knows what the primary, secondary, tertiary contributing factors are. So these teams are all just guessing. And, you might want to say the Mets guessed wrong, I guess, with Wheeler and what that elbow could endure.
I want to stick a pin in that because I do want to come back to that in just a sec. But the thing that strikes me is, so the ligament looked clean at some point previously. Is that your understanding, that at some point prior to this week, they actually looked at the ligament and it looked clean, or they just didn't look at the ligament, they looked at other stuff?
Well, if you go back on the timeline, Zach Wheeler had his first MRI on the elbow, as far as we're concerned. It was his first MRI back in September. The elbow was barking a little bit, so the Mets sent him in for a test. He was pitching really well at the time, and it came back, and it showed from what I understand, what an MRI would show for any pitcher. Just there's a little noise in there, but the ligament is intact and nothing to be worried about. Now, whatever pain, discomfort Wheeler was feeling didn't necessarily go away over the offseason when he was doing his normal progression to get ready for spring training. It started barking again. So he told the Mets, they flew him to New York. He had another MRI, and it showed the same thing. I think Terry Collins' words were it was, quote, clean as heck, which, again, any pitcher is going to have a little noise in there, so you have to take that with a grain of salt. But as far as the ulnar collateral ligament, the UCL, which is the injury, which is the ligament that when it tears, you need Tommy John surgery, as far as that goes, it was still intact. At least that's what the Mets are saying. And then all of a sudden, Wheeler's elbow starts barking again this spring. He goes back into the MRI tube. He comes out, and it's a complete tear. So when the ligament actually tore, I don't know. I don't think the Mets really know. I don't think Zach Wheeler knows. I don't think it happened necessarily on one pitch. But I think it's pretty clear at this point that there was no tear in January, and there is a tear now in March. And, you know, how that happened again is sort of anyone's guess.
So to go back, and obviously if that's in fact what happened and that something just went horribly wrong within the last 2 months, that's a different matter entirely. But the one thing I would ask about, because, I do agree sort of broadly that we don't really know, but, you know, it seems like the one thing we do know about arm injuries and elbow injuries is if you pitch when fatigued, it massively increases the risk. And whether there's a specific number, whether it's 90 or 100 or 120, is not really known and maybe beside the point. But if you pitch when tired, that's really when it happens, when fatigued. And so the thing I wonder about with Wheeler is not even necessarily the high counts, but the high counts and the low number of innings, the 100 pitches in 5 innings, 110 in 6, whatever they were. Is that something that, I mean, again, the Mets say they're fine with how they handled him, but is that specific thing something that maybe they revisit, not the total counts, but these high intensity, lot of pitches in a short time outings that the Wheeler in particular had?
Right, the high stress innings, which is what he's become known for in his career. He does throw a lot of pitches. He throws a lot of balls outside the strike zone, so his pitch counts in general tend to be higher than the other pitches. And I think there is probably something to that. I think there's probably something to the fact that he's one of the hardest throwing starting pitchers in baseball last season. I think that plays a role in why we're seeing so many more of these injuries in general, just because guys are throwing harder than they used to, and the human elbow is not necessarily equipped to handle that. But yeah, I think the fatigue factor definitely plays a role. It was Zach Wheeler's first full big league season on top of that. And then you go and you look at his September pitch counts. I believe he was 114 pitches his first September start, and over 100, I believe, in 4 of the 5. And yeah, you combine that with the fact that many of those were, it's not like he was going 8 innings and 114 pitches. It was almost always less than that, and really abbreviated starts. So there is something to that. How much? I honestly don't know. How much does the velocity matter? I honestly don't know, and I'm certainly not alone, you know, in baseball circles, because, like I said originally, no one knows. I think you can look at it logically and determine what the risk factors are, age being one, velocity being one, fatigue being one, but weighing them against each other is just really, really hard to do at this point.
So to move forward and to actually talk some baseball, it appears as though Dylan Gee is the guy. He's very much plug and play. It's the sort of path of least resistance. Is that clear to you that at least for now Dylan Gee slots into that position in the rotation and just kind of everybody else moves one step closer to being the next man up?
Yeah, Dylan Gee is the guy, and that's a great way to put it. It is kind of the path of least resistance. You know, if the Mets had had their way, they still would have traded Dylan Gee this winter. It turns out they're pretty fortunate that they didn't. But there are other candidates, not to step in right now, because Gee is going to be the guy. But you've got Rafael Montero, who the Mets still like as a starter. He'll probably open the year in the bullpen. And if Gee struggles, and he's already on the roster, I mean, I could see a quick switch with that. And then, you know, the two names that keep popping up from the minor leagues are Noah Syndergaard and Steven Matz, both the really legit blue chip prospects. Syndergaard being closer to the big leagues, but he had his struggles last year at AAA. If he can go out and really show in April that he's learned something, that he is ready to stop being a thrower and be more of a pitcher, which has been his problem coming up, you know, these guys are all on the cusp, but I wouldn't say Dylan Gee has a safe job now by any point. He'll get a few starts in April. The Mets respect him. You know, he's well-liked in the clubhouse, and I think that does actually play a role into this. And, you know, they respect his body of work over the past 4 or 5 years. But, you know, if he's not doing well over those first three, four, however many starts it may be, you could easily see a Montero or a Syndergaard jump in sooner rather than later.
I realize this would be basically a good problem to have, but say G is just fine. He's not so bad that he pitches his way out of the rotation, but he's not great, and Syndergaard goes down and puts it together. Is that a problematic scenario where in a month or 6 weeks or whatever, Syndergaard is ready and they can't really tell G you're bumped, or are they willing to say if the time comes and it's clear that the alternative is better than G, even if G's not struggling, will they be willing to pull that trigger to do the best thing for what they hope will be a contender?
Yeah, I mean, that would be a great problem for the Mets to have. It's a trigger they would probably be willing to pull. You know, if that were the case and G was pitching fine, I think then those Super 2 concerns creep in and the Mets will say, well, you know, G's pitching fine, so let's just leave him in there until late May, early June, whatever it may be, so we, you know, retain all of our leverage on Noah Syndergaard or Steven Matz, for that matter, if it happens to be him who's dominating at AAA. But yeah, it goes back to, you know, just looking at this year from a much broader perspective. The Mets are in it to win it this year. They're in it to make the playoffs. Just because Zach Wheeler goes down, that doesn't change, nor should it, because this was their number one area of depth. It was their number one strength, and they have all these guys that we're talking about now who are potential fill-ins who while they might not be able to put up the numbers that Zach Wheeler put up, you know, you can draw from that pool of depth and say, you know, this doesn't hurt us nearly as much as it would hurt some other teams. So with all that in mind and that mentality in mind, yeah, if they think Noah Syndergaard come May 15th is a better option to win games than Dylan Gee, I don't think they'd hesitate to pull that trigger. And the other factor is you've got, you know, one starting pitcher, Matt Harvey, who's coming off surgery himself, and they're going to be careful with him. You've got another starting pitcher in Bartolo Colon, who Sandy Alderson referred to as 60 the other day, which isn't that far off. So you don't know what's going to happen with him health-wise. You've got another starting pitcher, John Neese, who's had all sorts of elbow and shoulder problems. And, you know, it, as good a bet as just about anyone in baseball to miss some time over the course of the season. So odds are they're not going to have that problem. Odds are someone's going to go down at some point, even if it's just for a couple of weeks. So and then, you know, if Syndergaard's the guy at that time, he could come up and stick. So it is a little far-fetched, in my opinion, to think that way. But if Syndergaard is the best guy at the time, I think we'll go with him.
As a very wise manager I covered for a long time said, don't worry about it. Those problems tend to sort themselves out. Thanks for taking some time to chat here on MLB.com Extras, talking Miami Marlins with MLB.com's Marlins beat reporter, Joe Fusaro. Joe, one lingering topic all winter and into the spring has been Dan Herron. Is he going to report? Is he going to pitch? Is he going to retire? Does he want to be there? Herron has gotten there, and not only has he shown up and does he apparently want to be there, but he's dealing. What are you seeing from Herron this spring? It is admittedly very early, but it seems like the early returns are pretty encouraging.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Yeah, the command is there. You know, you're obviously a veteran guy who has been around a long time and knows how to kind of pace himself. And, you know, he's kind of right on schedule to be probably the fourth starter. And, you know, he seems happy. He's, you know, fitting well. He and Jared Cosart have bonded very nicely. Last couple of starts, he's worked with Jeff Mathis, who caught him a couple years ago with the Angels. And you know, I wouldn't be surprised if we see those guys matched up every time he gets on the mound during the season. But, yeah, here's a guy who's come to as advertised, you know, a guy who is going to give you a lot of innings, obviously not overpowering. But this is the time of year in spring training where the hitters tend to hit that 87-88 a lot better than 98. and they're not hitting him very well. So that's a very encouraging sign for Herron and the Marlins.
Is there still any question at all about whether he wants to be there, whether they look to move him, or is he at this point just saying, look, I'm here, we're going to do this?
No, I think he's bought in, and I know there's going to be rumblings whenever there's an injury. The Marlins have no interest in dealing him. They're not taking any calls on him or sending any out. You know, they fully anticipate him being in the rotation and being a big part of what they hope is going to be a fun year. So, you know, and then from all indications too, Herron's kind of acting like, you know, 2015 may not be his last year either. So, I think he's pitching to kind of prove that he still has stuff. I think the whole West Coast thing is a thing, you know, the past right now. Now, if he's a couple of months in the season and the results aren't as very good, we'll have to wait to see where his head's at then. But right now, you know, he just seems to be Dan Herron that people have got to know for the last 10 years.
Behind Herron, there are obviously some questions coming into camp. It seems like there still are. Is there a leader in that fifth starter race right now?
Boy, I don't even know if there's going to be a leader until the end of camp. And that may be based on roster spots. It may be based on, you know, hands out of options. I think he throws better in rotation than the bullpen. And so I think that is completely up for grabs. David Phelps is doing very well. Now, can he flat out win that job? Maybe, you know. So if anything of those three, Phelps is probably throwing the best right now and giving them the most to think about. But, you know, that hand Kohler Phelps race literally could come down to the end. And we've mentioned before, I think all three are going to be on the roster, whether, you know, the two that aren't in rotation are going to be thrown out of the bullpen. And I think they're prepared to go with two long guys, especially in April when the weather isn't good and pitchers aren't built up yet.
So is that maybe a situation where the fifth starter isn't necessarily the guy who clearly emerges as the best starter, that maybe is kind of the way those
Correct.
Pieces fit together dictates it as much as just a clear, this guy's the best and the other two do something else?
Yeah, I think that might actually happen. You know, you may have a guy, let's say Tom Kohler, who threw very well last year, might, you know, if he doesn't have a substantial lead, let's say, in that race, and they think hands, let's say, they feel, and they say, we want a lefty because they don't have a lefty, then possibly they go that route. So, again, a lot to be, you know, a lot to be determined, and health is, you know, going to be big too, obviously. But, you know, I think that is going to play into roster options and fit more than, you know, that may fall in the life ain't fair all the time category as well.
Kohler's kind of an interesting guy because he throws hard, but, you know, he doesn't always miss a lot of bats, at least relative to baseball in 2015. It's kind of funny to say a guy who struck out as
Correct.
Many as he doesn't miss a lot of bats, but in 2015, he doesn't miss a lot of bats for throwing as hard. Is he a guy who might have a future as a power reliever? Is he a guy that maybe if you shorten him up and just let it eat, that he might have a different look in the bullpen?
Matthew, I've always kind of thought the last couple of years that he could be a closer. I really have. You know, obviously how he throws out of the stretch and all that other stuff would come into play. But I honestly think he's got the makeup to do that and the tenacity to do that and the stuff to get a lot of outs and probably get some strikeouts too, which obviously you're going to need from your closer. So I think he could profile as that down the line. But right now, you know, I think that, you know, the way they're looking at this team, you're going to need 7 to 10 starters, and they got 10 who they are pretty comfortable with, you know, when Jose gets back in their system, and Kohler is part of that group. But that doesn't mean he won't be the long reliever, at least early on.
You're such a pro. You set me up for my next question. Give us another update on Jose Fernandez's progress, where he's at, how he's coming along.
Yeah, he's still on that, you know, Monday, Thursday program, just kind of doing his thing. You know, he's, you know, building up. We're not seeing a ton of him, which is probably a good thing. You know, he's staying busy with his rehab and not being overly over anxious, I should say. And you know, he's a guy that's still that time frame, you know, just filled up, kind of phase in some secondary pitches and your bullpen sessions. And, you know, we'll know more about him when we break camp, when he starts facing hitters on backfields. But for now, so far, so good. And, you know, just, you know, with him, he's so energetic. And if he were just, now that that's not that he's not in the clubhouse, because he certainly is, but, you know, if you just kind of got the feel of the game, he may kind of speed everything up and be a little over anxious. So it's probably good that he's just kind of pacing himself and doing his thing on the 2 days he throws off the mound and continues his throwing progression.
You had a piece recently. Dontrell Willis finally announced his retirement, and it's really been a sad story over the last several years for a guy who was so much fun to watch. But you were there at the start. I'm just curious to hear your impressions. When you saw Willis emerge, what was that like to cover, to be around? Because he really was a phenomenon in a way that not a lot of guys are in baseball.
This is the closest we had, at least in my coverage experience, to a Mark Fidrich, to a guy who was quirky and energetic and won and did it so much excitement and was loved by so many people. He was really a phenomenon for about 3, 4, 5 years here as a Marlin. Obviously, 03 is when he broke in and won Rookie of the Year, and they don't go to the World Series without him. You know, there's no question. They were 10 games under in the first half, and he went 9-1 in the first half. He almost single-handedly got them back to .500, where they really took off in the second half and did all the things that they did that year. Special person and player, and it is sad that, you know, we had that 3, 4, 5 year window when you thought he was on his way to a great career, and, you know, well, I don't think he pitched since 11, right, in the big league. So, you know, and then just trying one more time, and he's still so beloved by people in this clubhouse, in this organization. He hit, he fielded, he was just pure excitement. And, God, it shows you how quickly things can change in this sport. But, you know, every day when you come to the park and you cover this as a reporter, or if you go to a game as a fan, you're looking for players like Dontrell Willis to come and give you a reason to go to the ballpark. And it's really sad that he didn't go out on his terms, but what a legacy. And I certainly hope they kind of bring him back for his, you know, special day this year. And maybe that will be in the works.
Was it just a matter of a delivery that complex, just being kind of hard to keep in line and to repeat and to get back to where it needed to be? When he loses his command and control, do you think it comes down as much as anything to kind of having a delivery that's really hard to keep in line?
Yeah, that's part of it, Matthew. I think, and for some of us who have covered this team and we were there that day in Chicago, they played the White Sox. When he kind of had a rough play in the field, he covered the base and fell awkwardly. And we always wondered if he got hurt then, and never really let anyone know, you know, that he's hurt a little bit more. He, like everyone else, injured, was covering a bag and stumbled and fell on his arm, and he just never. It just kind of all rapidly declined. But you know, if we were looking at mechanics, no one really knew what to do. You know, there's still people that I talked to are like, they probably should just let him be. You know, never, you know, don't tinker with it, but you know how we are in the teaching end of it. When you look to repeat arm angles and you know, the high leg kick was fun the first year. They tempered that. But, you know, that velo was in mid to upper 90s for a little while, and you know, when the time the Marlins traded him, he was like at a low 90s, high 80s with his fastball. So, you know, he might have had an injury that we weren't aware of as well.
All right. Well, Joe Fusaro, thanks for taking some time to chat here on MLB.com Extras and talking Philadelphia Phillies with MLB.com's Phillies medical correspondent and beat reporter Todd Zalecki. Todd, the obviously by far the biggest news this week coming out of Phillies camp is the situation with Cliff Lee. I don't know that it's really a surprise to anybody. We talked before that he didn't really want to have surgery, and even non-surgical rehab is a fairly miserable experience. So what can you sort of how can you sort of illuminate Lee's decision-making process here? Because it's obviously the guy would like to be able to pitch, but surgery is not a good option, and non-surgical rehab is not a great option.
Yeah, he definitely wants to pitch. You can tell he's frustrated. People that have talked to him, teammates and whatnot, say that it's definitely taken a toll on him mentally. But I really think it comes down to this. Even a couple of years ago when he was pitching great and he was healthy, he was expressing frustrations with, you know, not winning and whatnot, and said, hey, you know what, this is probably going to be my last contract. I don't see myself pitching after my contract expires, which kind of illuminated or shed a little bit of light on his thinking about his career after this contract expires after this season. So the arm injury, the tear in the tendon does not go away, obviously. He tried rehabbing from it twice without success. And he has said in the past, you know, honestly, I don't even know if I want to go through the rehab if I have surgery. Like, I might just shut it down at that point if it comes down to me having to have surgery to continue my career. So he's going to give it one more shot at the rehab, non-surgical rehab. I couldn't even put odds on it, but it would take, you got to think it would almost take a miracle at this point to see him pitching again this season. But he has to try. I mean, the cold hard facts of it is, you know, he does have a contract. He's owed $37.5 million, a $25 million salary this year, plus a $12.5 million buyout. So he has to make some sort of effort to pitch. He can't just go, guys, I'm not going to have the surgery. I'm just going to go back to Arkansas and hang out with my family, and that'll be the end of it. So he's got to try. He's got to make some sort of attempt, even though it's probably very, very futile. And that's kind of where it stands. I think everybody kind of knows that if it happens, boy, something really dramatic has happened and something really unforeseen has happened. Because really, I can't find anybody in camp right now that expects Cliff Lee to pitch again.
Is there any kind of creative solution? Could he be a one-inning reliever? I mean, is there anything? Is there anything surprising or odd or creative on the table here?
I don't think so. I think that this is, you know, he wants to start. I don't think he has any interest in being a relief pitcher. And I don't think it's anything that the Phillies are necessarily interested in. You know, they've got a lot of young relief pitchers, I think, that they want to get a good look at this season. So if it means Cliff Lee taking a spot on the roster as relief pitcher last couple months of the season or getting a longer look at maybe a young up-and-comer, I think that, honestly, at this point, they'd rather take a look at the young up-and-comer.
At what point does the time come, do you think, that Cliff Lee says, you know what, I'm done, I retire? Is that the end of this season? Is it, I mean, what has to happen? How many more steps does he have to go through, or how much time does he have to try this before he says, look, this is a lost cause, I'm done?
Honestly, I don't think it'll probably happen until after the season or close to towards the end of the season. So last year he pitched right before the trade deadline in Washington, and that was his last start. He came out of that game, so that was July 29th, July 30th, something along those lines. He did not get cleared to throw again until, I think, mid-November. So that's several months of basically just resting and not picking up a baseball. So that's August, September, October, 3.5 months. Now, if he goes 3.5 months or longer at this point, now we're looking, he doesn't pick up a baseball until July. You know, best case scenario, what, does he get back on the mound in the last couple months of September maybe? So I don't think he's going to get to that point. I think they're kind of, it's kind of almost a going through the motions type of thing, just to say he's giving it his best. And so I think at the end of the season, when all is said and done, you know, he'll say he's going to retire, then, you know, he'll get that buyout, and then he'll probably just walk away from the game.
Does this in any way, I preface this by saying they probably knew that this was at least a possibility before even the first pitch of spring training was thrown. So I realize it's not a shock to the Phillies to be dealing with, but does this situation in any way affect the decision on how they proceed with Cole Hamels?
I don't think so, and I say that because the Phillies are looking at it as two separate situations. Now, you know, you look at it obviously right away and you say, oh man, you know, if they just lost Cliff Lee, like, you know, should they not try to trade Cole Hamels ASAP in case, you know, just to avoid the possibility that he gets hurt? But the Phillies aren't looking at it that way because they say, listen, Cliff had a torn ligament in his elbow last year. We knew that. And we, you know, and the elbow still has a tear in it. Cole is healthy. He's never had a serious shoulder or elbow injury. So we're going to take the chance, and they think it's a pretty good chance that he's going to stay healthy and wait until they can get what they consider to be the best deal possible. So they're not going to rush into it. And I wrote something recently. The Phillies have two examples, and they're not positioned past, of what happens when you maybe rush into a trade. Ed Wade, former GM, traded Curt Schilling to the Diamondbacks in 2000 because Curt was making a lot of noise. He was criticizing ownership. He was criticizing the front office. He clearly did not want to be there. And frankly, Ed Wade, I think, was tired of it and made a trade with the Diamondbacks. And Ed has said, you know, looking back on it, I wish I had not felt so obligated to trade the guy. I wish I would have held on to him. Maybe we would have started to turn things around. Maybe we would have changed his mind. Maybe he would have stayed, or maybe we would have just taken the draft picks. And then the other example is Cliff Lee in 2009 with the Mariners. The Phillies acquired Roy Halladay. Phillies president David Montgomery told Ruben, he's like, listen, if you're going to give up three or four more prospects to get Roy Halladay, you've got to bring some more prospects into the system. You can't just empty out the farm system for all these guys. And so they ended up trading Cliff Lee. And Ruben has said in the past, you know what, looking back on it, I wish I could have given myself a little bit more time to find a better deal. So I think the Phillies have that very much in the back of their minds when they look at Cole Hamels. Just because Cliff Lee got hurt doesn't mean we should now go, all right, Boston, we know you're not going to give us Blake Swihart or Mookie Betts. We'll take, you know, some of these prospects that we're not super excited about just because maybe there's a chance that Cole Hamels gets hurt at some point.
Well, let me turn this in the other direction, because I think what's interesting to me is, you know, you look at this club, and if you're in the position of one of their players, and you say you're looking for reasons to compete and reasons to make sure you think you've got something to fight for, and you say, okay, we got Hamels, and we got Lee, and we got a bunch of guys who have done it in the past offensively, and Howard and Utley and all these guys. Well, now you take Lee for sure out of that. And right now you take the 3 and 4 starters and you put them in question with Harang and Williams. And so what I wonder at this point is, if you're somebody like Chase Utley, if you're somebody like, well, I guess Papelbon's kind of a different issue, but some of these veteran guys who have been unsure about whether they want to be dealt, do their situations get hastened just because they maybe look around and say, yeah, okay, if you want to move me, let's go ahead and do this?
Yeah, I think that's definitely a possibility, and Chase alluded to that during his news conference here in Clearwater the first week of camp, saying, hey, I want to stay in Philly. I have no desire to leave. And then the next question was, well, what if they trade Cliff and Cole and Papelbon and Howard and Carlos Ruiz or just even a few of those guys? And he said, well, at that point, I might have to rethink things. And I think that this is one of those things that could happen, you know, especially if Aaron Harang, you know, they say he's going to be fine with the back. You know, they say Jerome Williams is going to be fine with his hamstring. You know, but if these guys are, you know, down for a specific amount of time or and the team really gets off worse than they expected, then I think certainly in the case of Chase Utley, he might say, hey, Ruben, you know, if you can find somebody to send me to, you know, but let's talk because, you know, my opinion has changed.
Let's try and end this on a little more upbeat note. You've written a couple times about Odubel Herrera and how he's kind of caught some eyes. What are you seeing from him, and what kind of opportunity is there for him?
I think there's a really good opportunity. He's really been impressive, and it is just spring training, but this is a guy who he won the batting title in the Texas League, the double A last year with Texas. He won the batting title in the Venezuelan Winter Ball. I've talked to some scouts that say, Before he got to camp, this guy can really hit. Like he can hit. I mean, he can run. You know, he's adjusting from being an infielder to an outfielder. But the key phrase here is he can hit. And the Phillies need players, young players that can hit. Now, I'm not saying he's going to be a superstar or an everyday player. Time will tell on that. But he is definitely one of the brighter spots in camp. I would be absolutely stunned at this point if he does not make the opening day roster. There's no reason for him not to make the opening day roster. And he's certainly shown a lot of promise. I was talking to a scout just the other day, and he said one of the higher-ups that I say that I work with said that, you know, he's probably the best hitter on the team behind Utley, and which is, again, spring training talk, and, you know, scouts say a lot of different things. But you know, it's noteworthy nonetheless that he's getting a lot of attention this spring. And quite frankly, I think if he can hit a little bit to start the season, this is a guy that could possibly get into the rotation with a few starts during the week, during the regular season, because the Phillies are certainly looking for offense.
All right. Well, Todd Zielecki, thanks for taking some time to talk here on MLB.com Extras, and thanks, everybody, for listening.